In the midst of all the coverage of January 6, 2021, you may have heard one of the insurrectionist slogans mentioned through the reporting, "Remember Waco." With the 30th anniversary of the historic siege at Waco approaching next month, it is clear that the message and radicalization that would result in a 51-day standoff in 1993 is alarmingly relevant today. Kevin Cook provides a definitive account of the deadly Waco siege in his new book, Waco Rising, David Koresh, the FBI, and the Birth of America's Modern Militias. Far from being an isolated incident, Cook draws a straight line from Waco's ashes to January 6th and the riot at the U.S. Capitol and insurrections yet to come. Kevin Cook is the author of over 10 books, including The Burning Blue and 10 Innings at Wrigley. He has written for The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal. He will be talking about and signing his book Tuesday night at 7 p.m. at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts. And it's a delight to welcome Kevin Cook to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Hello, Joe. It's good to be with you.
Very nice to have you on the program. I'm an admirer of your work, and it's very nice to have read this book and to talk to you about it. So I thank you for that. What brought you to the subject of Waco?
I remember it, and I think like millions of other people, I remember it vividly as a fiery moment on television. My previous book was about the something in some ways similar. It was about Christa McAuliffe and the 1986 Challenger space shuttle explosion, another moment that we remember vividly, that people even remember where they were standing when it happened, another moment early in round-the-clock news coverage. CNN was still relatively new, so people who could get obsessed with what was happening could follow it almost around the clock. And like that other fiery disaster, this one wound up being more fascinating. I think the story behind the story is even more fascinating than the little most of us remember, and it got more fascinating the longer I looked at it.
When you start to tell the story, where for you is the best place to begin with what happened in Waco?
I think one starts on February 28th in 93. That's when the ATF rolled up the driveway, disguised in tarps, cattle trucks, almost 100 heavily armed agents in riot gear, barrel up. Now they're serving a search warrant, and they pile out of these cattle trucks on February the 28th. David Koresh comes out the door and then ducks back inside, and pretty soon the worst firefight in law enforcement memory is underway, with the shots going both directions. It's impossible, I believe, to say who fired the first shots. There are several accounts and interesting possibilities that I deal with in Waco Rising. What happened next, though, is that the FBI relieved the ATF, which had botched the delivery of the serving of a search warrant. The FBI took over, and this event devolved into what the FBI considered a hostage barricade situation. And the FBI had its procedures for that. But this was not a hostage barricade situation. This was a situation in which a lot of very sincere religious people who followed a man who believed that one of their jobs was to assemble an arsenal in case they had to fight against the forces, the godless forces of quote-unquote Babylon outside, settled into a siege, a standoff. They were surrounded by hundreds of law enforcement agents who eventually the FBI deployed psychological warfare operations against them, training spotlights on the compound where they lived. They did not want to come out. They did not see themselves as hostages. And blaring music, the sounds of animals being slaughtered, telephones ringing at absolute top volume that can be heard miles away, gongs and Gregorian chants and Nancy Sinatra singing "These Boots Are Made for Walking." All this done to American citizens by American law enforcement. Not all the Davidians were American citizens, but many were. There were many women and children inside. They were misled, I certainly believe, by David Koresh, who convinced them that only he could understand the Bible. To me, it was a terrible historical collision between an unhinged leader and a government that made many wrong decisions.
February 28th to April 19th of 1993 is how long that standoff lasted. My question is just going back of what brought, in your research, what brought many people, how long had that particular group, let's say, had been in the compound and been with David Koresh?
They'd been on that site for generations, for decades, not following Koresh. He took over as their prophet, succession of prophets. He took over as their prophet in the 80s after a shootout on the property that got him arrested for attempted murder of a previous claimant to being the prophet of the Davidians, a fellow named George Roden, who was quite a figure and gun-toting, as most of the folks down there were at that time. After Koresh took over, that is when they built the compound in which they lived. They saw it as their home. It's often called a facility, and the FBI hung it with the name compound, in the same way as the Davidians were often called a cult. I don't know if that word is fair. I think sect is certainly right, an offshoot of Seventh-day Adventists, who are people who believe that the world is soon to come to an end, as predicted in the book of Revelation in the Bible. Koresh's great virtue in their eyes was that he was a great speaker. He could weave the confusing messages in the Bible together in a way that made a mesmerizing story and that made his followers feel, I think, that their lives had meaning, which is something we all want. They were going to follow him. He took it further and further, though, as time passed. He told the men, the married men and women among his followers, that their marriage was basically annulled by him and that the men would no longer be sleeping with their wives, that only Koresh would, because it was his job to populate the world for a potential battle against Babylon. He ruled every bit of their lives, from what they ate to the times that they woke and slept. He took quote-unquote wives as young as 12 and 13 years old. In many of those ways, he was typical of being a cult leader. He was also dying for publicity. Time and Newsweek put him on the cover, calling him an evil messiah, and he thought that was terrific because he was looking for his picture. He was quite a figure. I think he misled his followers. I think they were sincere. He was very dangerous. It was like pouring a mixture of terrifically flammable, horrible, combustible elements together in Waco in 93.
What was it, the rationale, if you will, for the government to come in with a search warrant?
They believed correctly that the Davidians were illegally transforming, converting semi-automatic weapons into automatic weapons, quote-unquote assault rifles. This is definitely illegal and can get you in a great deal of trouble. It's not the kind of thing that one generally loses one's life for. They needed to get this search warrant, and in order to do that, officials of the ATF convinced a judge that the Davidians were also running a methamphetamine lab, which was not true. They had actually encountered one on the property when they got there, left over by that fellow in the cowboy hat, George Roden, before tenants that he had, and they had cleaned it up. They were anti-drug. There were later many reports from the FBI that the Davidians, particularly Koresh, was beating children, beating babies. That was the quote that was told to brand new Attorney General Janet Reno, who had built her career on fighting child abuse. And while the Davidians did practice corporal punishment, there was no sign of beatings on the children who came out during the showdown. There was, beyond doubt, a great deal of sexual abuse, I believe, going on in that compound that many of their parents allowed because they believed that this was part of their religion, as Koresh told them. But he was not beating babies. They were not beating babies. That was another way that Janet Reno was pressured to give the okay for the ultimate tear gas attack that led to the fire after 51 days of the siege.
Kevin Cook is our guest. The name of the new book is Waco Rising, David Koresh, the FBI, and the Birth of America's Modern Militias. He will be speaking about and signing the book Tuesday night at 7 p.m. at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts. And you can find out more by going to odysseybks.com. Let us talk about the ATF. They're planning for the raid. What went into that planning, and what it seems like in your telling of the story, so much was missed. So bring us to the planning of the raid and what they thought would happen, and where they got things very, very, very wrong.
Well, they did a great deal of training at a nearby military base for this raid planning. As we said, the piling into a pair of cattle trucks. There was an entire convoy a mile long coming up the highway approaching Waco before the raid on February 28th. They had planned so fully what they expected to happen that they brought some McDonald's meals. They brought candy for the children that they expected to be coming out that day. They did not expect to get themselves into a furious shootout. As it turned out, however, the Davidians had been tipped off. One of their members was a local mail delivery person, and he was out delivering the mail when a local TV reporter stopped him and asked for directions, which way to the compound where those Branch Davidians are. And why do you want to know? Well, the cameraman who was asking for directions said, well, there's a lot of training going on around here, helicopters, something big time is going to happen, and you better get out of here and stay away from there before the shooting starts. The mail carrier immediately zipped back to the compound, let Koresh know. At that point, the ATF should have called off the raid. And they actually did know that the Davidians knew they were coming. The heavily armed Davidians knew they were coming. And when they did pile out of those cattle trucks, and the reason they were cattle trucks covered in tarps was trying to fool these people. I mean, here you are trying to serve a search warrant, and you speed up the drive, and almost 100 agents leap out, go up ladders. Suddenly, it's really like a military operation against a compound right here on American soil. It was a huge mistake, especially against people as well-armed as the Branch Davidians were. By the time the shooting was over at the end of that day, there were 4 ATF agents dead and 6 Davidians dead. That raised the stakes so horrendously because, as the Davidians knew, they were what amounted to cop killers at that point. And if they ever did surrender and come out, they were going to be arrested and charged with killing federal agents.
It is, I just want to skip ahead for a moment because of something I just couldn't get out of my head, that you visited the site of the compound. I did this, I guess, in 2019.
Oh, did you?
Right before COVID, and I was fascinated by it. There is a chapel there, and a pastor who now is promoting theories tied to QAnon.
I bring this up for two reasons. One is that, you know, I remember being talking on the show 5 years ago about the 25th anniversary, and that was before mm-hmm. January 6th. And now here we are. We're at the 30th anniversary, and a lot has changed. It seems like we look at this differently because of that. But through the eyes of what is happening now at the compound and what it means and the fact that people still go to it, what do you think that tells us?
I think it tells us that the ashes of Waco are as almost as hot as they were immediately after the fire, when there were unspent rounds popping off left and right, that in some sense America is still picking up the pieces of this disaster that occurred there. How did it seem to you when you were at the chapel? I was surprised that there's a great deal of merchandise. It is very, very political down there, and many of the visitors, not by any means the majority, I don't think, but many are militia members from around the country who are really making pilgrimages
right
to the hub, a hub of what they see as the Patriot movement.
A lot of people, I mean, obviously a lot of Trump flags, a lot of that type of merchandise. So this, mm-hmm. again, I was in 2019, so place that in its context. But also the thing that really struck me is, again, by how many people were there and how many, I mean, myself included, but I think from a journalist perspective, I was interested in going, and also seeing the memorial that is there with mm-hmm. the names of those who died on that day. And it's eerie. It's just eerie. We had a gentleman in not too long ago who wrote a book with Paul Auster about sites of school shootings and how so many of them mm-hmm. have been razed and have been taken off the map. And the fact that there are remnants still of that place, I found fascinating.
Yes, I did too, and it is eerie is a good word for it. I was struck and in a way pleased to see that among the many memorials to the Davidians who died there, there is one to the four ATF agents
yes.
who died there. And you are in the heart of something that, as you say, there's a great deal of QAnon talk going on from the current pastor and the reading material that's inside the chapel, a chapel that was paid for, by the way, by Alex Jones. He raised the funds to build that tidy white chapel on the site, and it opened in 2000. He began his career as a shouter in Texas, grew up nearby, and claimed it was a murderous conspiracy by the government. This is what many believe to this day, and I did feel like there was that one possible sign that the polarization that seems to strike everything today might eventually pass was the fact that there are memorials to both the Davidian dead and the four ATF agents who died.
I mean, you point out that membership in far-right militia groups jumped after the incident. And again, you look at just what happened in January 6th and that idea of the Patriot movement. So it obviously never went away, but we are in a place now where we also see membership increasing and wondering sort of what is bubbling under the surface that we're not aware of, about. So much of it is out in the open, so much of it is online, so much we see in our communities, and it's hard to drive down the main street of any town in this country and not see evidence of either a Confederate flag or a Trump flag or whatever the case may be. But it is interesting that has grown, and as I said, that's the overt part, and I'm sort of interested in also what's still left underground.
Yes, it's true. I think that I spoke to an FBI agent who was embedded, who infiltrated a number of more violent militia members, and he told me that he had barely encountered one who didn't consider what happened at Waco as his or her awakening to the government. The people who believe firmly in Second Amendment rights believe that Waco proved that this is a government that is out to take your guns. And if you don't submit and surrender them, then it will go as far as to kill you. Even though I think the government eventually, the FBI, was trying to flush them out of that compound and not try to kill them, nonetheless, it led directly to their deaths. I was struck. I didn't know before I visited Waco that one of the people selling bumper stickers during the siege was a Koresh and Davidian supporter named Timothy McVeigh.
Yes.
Who went on to strike back, in his view, against the murderous government 2 years later, and he chose the anniversary of the fire at Waco to blow up the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City.
What do you think it is? I mean, the one thing that's missing from January 6th, this is debatable, of course. We only have about 2 minutes left. But one of the things that's missing from the Waco story to the January 6th is the religious component and that idea of a savior, except that you talk to people who thought of and think of Donald Trump as the savior.
That's true, and there is still a great deal of Trump memorabilia on sale there. I think that in a somewhat similar way, the Davidians had chosen to follow David Koresh wherever he told them to go, to do whatever he told them to do, because they believed he was divinely inspired. There may well be some of that, certainly in the insurgents who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. I was very struck by the comment from one of the survivors who got out of the fire by diving through a burning wall, who said, we were not white supremacists. We believe in gun rights, the Davidians did, but didn't want to do violent things. And when he hears people say that Donald Trump is their savior, he wonders, and here they thought that we followed the wrong guy.
Well, the book is fascinating. It is Waco Rising, David Koresh, the FBI, and the Birth of America's Modern Militias. It is a fascinating account of what happened in 1993 and why it is so relevant and why it means and matters so much to us today. Kevin Cook is the author of Waco Rising. He will be talking about and signing the book on Tuesday night at 7 p.m. at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts. You can find out more information about that event by going to odysseybks.com, odysseybks.com. Kevin Cook, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us, and best of luck with the book.
Joe, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Be well. Thank you. Again, Kevin Cook's new book is Waco Rising. We'll be at Odyssey Bookshop Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. OdysseyBKS.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.